Hi guys, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me out here. That's the end of this. This is done. I wore it up here. You saw that. So if my sponsor asks, I wore it. Quakertown, I didn't know. Well, Quakertown is exactly what I thought Quakertown. I got off the thruway and I thought maybe we were going to be in a cornfield. It basically is, yeah, I know. But it's beautiful out here, and it's a beautiful group. I got up here a little bit early, and I was able to meet some of you, and I appreciate it. I like the spirit that's in this group. It's a familiar spirit. It's a spirit I come from in Buffalo, New York. It's language of the heart. You know, it's good to know that you can jump on the thruway and travel for 6 hours and come and just be right at home. Be right at home, and it's a cool deal. And this Philadelphia area has a ton of speaker meetings. It's a pretty cool thing to see. We don't have a lot of that in Buffalo, New York. So actually, me and a bunch of the guys I sponsor, we're starting one in Buffalo, New York. So we're looking forward to that. And that also means stay away from me after the meeting because I might have you driving to Buffalo, New York. It's an honor and privilege to be able to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, to even be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. To be honest with you, it's an honor and privilege. It's a gift. It's by God's grace that I'm able to do anything. See, I don't deserve any of this. I don't deserve to be in a suit. I don't deserve to be in an air-conditioned car all day while I'm communicating with friends over the speaker. I don't deserve to be sitting on the beach yesterday with a beautiful little girl who I call a daughter, who calls me daddy. I don't deserve any of it. It's all a direct result of destroying my life, of absolutely destroying my life. I was sickened terribly by alcoholism. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love God. And I'm very passionate about both those things because they didn't just help me in life. They literally saved my life. God saved my life. And the vehicle he used is the program and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have a tendency to talk passionately about those things, and especially when I'm sharing my experience and where I am today and how I see where I am today in those things, the truths that are available to me today. And I don't mean to talk at anybody or to imply that anybody else's deal is wrong. I'm only here to share my experience. And my experience is that I've had a deep and effective spiritual experience, which has revolutionized my attitude towards life, God, and his kids. And revolutionize means turn around completely. Turn around completely. The man who stands at this podium this evening is not the same person who was Drug and Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years ago. I should say that my sobriety date is November 1st, 1997. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I am a sponsor, and I recovered from alcoholism as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is a Three Legacies group, meets on right now as we speak. It's meeting. It's a big book oriented group. We drive topics that come directly out of our book and talk about them. And our chairman helps the meeting stay on topic. And it's an enthusiastic group. And I believe in all three sides of the triangle. I don't just believe in the 12 steps. I also believe in the traditions and the concepts. And I think all three sides of the triangle are vital for my own personal recovery and my own personal spiritual well-being. So I'll tell you, I'm the real alcoholic. I picked up a drink when I was about 12 years old. Probably not quite 12, more like 11, 12 years old. I remember I was sitting with a bunch of my friends and it was a hot summer day and we decided we were bored and I was making up stories of grandeur, and we went up to my grandfather's bar. We broke into that bar and I grabbed a bottle of Southern Comfort. Now I'm 11 years old. I don't know the difference between a bottle of vodka and a bottle of Southern Comfort. But Southern Comfort was there, so I picked up the Southern Comfort and we put it in my pants and went up to an alley. And we dipped behind the alley and I pulled out the bottle, cracked open the bottle of Southern Comfort. And I took a big pull off of that. And I don't know, you know, if I was expecting it to taste like Kool-Aid or whatever, 11 years old. I'm here to tell you, and I don't have to tell anybody here, Southern Comfort doesn't taste like Tropical Punch Kool-Aid. That stuff kicked my butt going in and almost came right back out. And I'm choking on it, and I passed the bottle. It was about two other guys in that rotation. And it got back around to me, and I took a second pull off that bottle of Southern Comfort. And it wasn't quite as bad as the first pull. I took a third pull off that bottle of Southern Comfort, which wasn't as bad as the first two pulls. And I don't know, guys, if it was the fourth pull or the fifth pull or the sixth pull, but somewhere in the process of drinking on that bottle of Southern Comfort, something happened. And I absolutely fell head over heels in love with the effect produced by alcohol. I absolutely loved it. I don't remember, I didn't join a home group after that, not much really happened except for I found something that I was extremely interested in. And almost right out of the chute, I tried to get alcohol as much as I could, as often as I could. See, in the very beginning, it was a solution to what I always felt like I didn't quite fit in, right? I didn't quite measure up. I was always living life inside of my head. I just couldn't function. And when I drank alcohol, it just all went away. And I was okay with where I was and who I was with and what I was doing. And I absolutely loved that feeling. It was liberating, absolutely liberating. And so that's what I did, is I sought out alcohol as a solution. And I can tell you that, our stories can go all different kinds of ways. I'm taught to stand up here and tell you in a general way what happened to me. And I can spare you a lot of the intricate details of what happened to me specifically while I drank, because that's as different as the individual themselves, right? I mean, obviously a city kid drinking, the things that happen to them is going to look a little bit different than a country kid drinking, right? But I can tell you that I suffer from a common peril, which is alcoholism, which is a threefold illness. It's mental, it's physical, and it's spiritual. Right. And when I drink alcohol, I react differently to alcohol than my friends, than everybody else that I know. I have this allergy to alcohol. So when I ingest alcohol in my system, I react abnormally. And when I stop drinking alcohol, I can't guarantee that I'm going to stay that way. And I repeated that over and over and over and over again. And it also seems to me that as much as I fell in love with the effect produced by drinking, I can't stand the effect produced by not drinking in and of itself. And it creates a circumstance where I fall victim to that desperate experiment one more time. And it doesn't matter how great the necessity or the wish, doesn't matter how bad the cards are stacked against me, doesn't matter how bad I can't drink anymore. I drink, because that's what I do. And I got this allergy. So I remember I was a baseball player. I loved baseball. I still love baseball. And I was really good at it when I was younger. And I had somewhat of a potential career or at least some sort of scholarship my way. And I was a pitcher, and I woke up, I was about 12, 13 years old. I woke up and I had a huge playoff game. I was starting that night against our rivals. And I remember waking up and I felt uneasy about it, just uneasy. Like, I got to pitch this game. Am I feeling all right? And got a hell of a lineup I'm facing tonight. And as I'm thinking about all this stuff, the phone rings, and it's a couple of my buddies from the blocks. It's my buddies from a couple blocks to the left. And they said that so-and-so just got out of jail and they're over there celebrating. They got a couple cases of Budweiser. Why don't you come over and celebrate? And I thought, well, I got this game, but I don't want to be rude. You know, they're inviting me, and he did, you know, serve jail time. That's a badge of, you know, we felt bad for you if you did that. He's welcome home. And so I said, you know what, I'll pop by. You know, I'll pop by. And I hung up the phone. I started getting ready to stop by to welcome my friend home. And I started thinking about those couple cases of Budweiser. And I started thinking, you know, am I going to drink or am I not going to drink, right? I mean, that's, you know, maybe I'll just have one. I'll probably have one, because if everybody's drinking, I don't want to be that guy. You know, I don't want them to think I'm better than them. What are you, Mr. Baseball Player? You can't have a beer with us, right? I'll have one. Maybe I'll have two. Depends on how much is there. I don't, you know, a lot of us are underage, so you have a couple cases of Budweiser. It's not just a matter of going to the store and buying it. There's some work involved in that. And so they went through great lengths. I don't want to be, you know, I'll have a couple beers. And, you know, and then I start doing like the beer math. Like, well, it's only noon. I don't got to be to the game till about 6. You know, that's just for warm up. So even if I go and I'm a little bit woozy at 6, you know, I still got an hour to sweat it out of me, and I'll be fine. I'll have two or three at the most, you know, no more than four, three or four, and we're done. And I'm not drinking past three. So I'll have three or four, and we're cutting it off at 3 o'clock. This way everybody's happy and, you know, we'll be fine. And, you know, the thing is, I'm like getting ready while all this, I'm getting ready and I'm heading over there and I'm just consumed with this idea. It's all consuming idea of drink or don't drink or not drink or don't drink. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear the mental obsession and I don't even know what the heck you're talking about, because it was just so much. I thought that's what you did. You worried about drinking and not drinking and how you're going to drink and how you're not going to drink. Right. And my drinking career is not characterized by countless ways to try to quit drinking. My drinking career, like page 30 says, is characterized by countless ways to try to control and enjoy it. Right. I want to drink the way I want to drink without the consequences to go with it. That's my obsession. How do I drink like I like drinking and still keep her? Right. Or still keep the baseball career, or still stay out of jail, or get them off my back. I'm obsessed with that idea. How do you make drinking work? Quitting drinking, who does that? There's no reason for me to quit drinking. I love drinking. I love it. I love it. So I get over there and somebody must see me coming, because the second I open the threshold of that door, a Budweiser can full is flying towards me. And I snagged it and I cracked it open, and you know, by the end of that beer, I had that thing happen to me that happened to me at that in that alley with that Southern Comfort that happened to me every single time in between, that feeling that just comes over, you know. So I go from I don't know what I'm going to do or say to this cocky little smirk that just kind of permanently plants on my face. And I got that swagger, that beer swagger that I absolutely love. And in the course of talking, I had the thought of something to the extent of, well, you know, one's getting me feeling pretty good. Another one's not going to hurt. Right? Or it is still early. I said I'd have no more than 3 or 4. It's not 3 o'clock yet. Got a couple hours. Right? And I always had a justification or a rationalization why I had that second and third and fourth and fifth. Even if the justification was screw it, it was always a reason. I had no idea that I had no choice in the matter. I had no idea that when I put that first bottle of, or first can of beer, first drink into my mouth, bottle, whatever it is, glass, can, 40, it doesn't matter what it is. The second I ingest that, I'm no longer drinking for any of the reasons why I think I'm drinking. I'm drinking to overcome a craving that's beyond my control. And that's paramount to everything, including the love of my life at that time, which was baseball. See, I wouldn't have missed that game for $1 million. Not for $1 million. I didn't make it to that game. And I'm different than my fellows, because the funny thing is there was people at that party that were drinking the same beer I was drinking at the same time I was drinking it that made it to that game as spectators. And the starting pitcher was just inebriated, done, in the living room floor. And so I ended up walking home kind of in a brownout, not quite a blackout, having some idea of what happened. And I woke up the next morning and the phone rang. Remember that? Early morning phone calls, or even worse. It's easy now because everybody's got the caller ID. Back then, it was a matter of you had to let that thing ring 7 times before your answering machine picked up. And then you had to listen to your voice. And then you just pray it's nobody and it's them. And they want to know. They got questions. They've always got questions. Where were you? Why'd you do that? What happened to you? And those aren't terrible questions if you have the answer to them. They're pretty reasonable questions. But the problem was I had no idea. I have no idea where I wasn't at that game. It wasn't because I wanted to let my team down. It's the last thing I want to do. I love those guys. They're good guys. It's not because I don't like baseball. I absolutely love baseball. I love baseball more than my own family. It's not because I felt like partying that night. I didn't feel like partying. I felt like playing baseball. I just had a couple, and I don't know what happened. I don't know what to tell you. I have no idea. So all I can do is sit there in panic and terror. Panic and terror. The phone rings, and I let it screen, and it happens to be a couple of my buddies 2 blocks from the right, so I pick it up. I go, hey, what's going on? And I say, you'll never believe what happened to me last night. And I explained the whole situation to them. You know what they said? They said, you know, you keep hanging out with those guys, I'm telling you, they're no good. They're no good. You got to get away from those guys. Why don't you come over? We got a 40 of malt liquor sitting in the fridge. It's yours. Relax. We'll think about this and we'll figure it out. I mean, just hearing the fact that there's malt liquor on the other side of that phone, you know, all that fear and terror was replaced with great faith. I just need to get to that bottle. I need to get to that bottle so I can calm down and figure this out. Figure out what the problem really is. And there it is. I mean, that's drinking every day, day in and day out. Drink. And it's because I got this, I'm coupled with this obsession and this this allergy. And I have no idea that that's what's going on. I don't have, there's definitely a progression to my illness. I don't keep drinking and just missing games. I keep drinking and I get into lots of trouble. I keep drinking and I stop going to school altogether. I keep drinking. I'm 15 years old and I'm hanging out with people 19, 20, 23 years old who are bad news. They have long rap sheets and I'm just done with school. And the reason why I'm done with school is because you can't drink and go to school at the same time. I tried, right? I tried. They know when a 12-year-old's walking down the hall drunk. So I just quit going. I quit going. I started hanging out with these guys and we start doing things that people who skip school do, hanging out in those places. And I love alcohol. And it gets to the point where I'm, I'll tell you what it looks like for my family and my family's angle. See, I thought I was just trying to figure it all out. I was convinced that's all it was. And these people kept getting in my way, right? The ones I loved or anybody, any authority figure getting in my way. What it looked like for my family was it was my stepfather sleeping on one side of the bed and my mother sleeping on the other side of the bed. And my little sister was sleeping in between them and they had a baseball bat on either side and they had a firearm at the foot of the bed. And they slept every night in terror because they had no idea who I owed money to, who I was out there pissing off, who was looking for me, or what kind of condition I was going to come home in. And they finally decided they couldn't do that anymore. And when I was a real little kid, vaguely remember, have recollections of being down in the city of Buffalo with my mother, and we're at a red light, and I looked over, and there was this bum. And he looked cold and tired and desperate, and he saw something on the floor, and he dove after, and he cleaned it off, and it was somebody else's half-smoked cigarette. And he cleaned it off, and he put it in his mouth, and he lit it, and the light turned green, and we went forward. And I remember just rifling off all kinds of questions to my mother. Because I couldn't understand how anybody can get there. I mean, how do you get there? You're a little kid. I just couldn't get it. How you can get there. No idea. And I'm 15 years old. And I went from being one of the most popular, if not the most popular kid in multiple neighborhoods to in this family who was, you know, willing to raise me up to that point. To nobody's left. I have nobody to call. And it's the dead of winter in Buffalo. And I'm freezing. And I'm tired. And it's the third month in a row I've had no place to call home. And I've gotten to the point where I'm really good at determining when my lips are turning blue just from the feel of it. Because one of my biggest fears at that point was getting frostbite or anything that would have to bring me to the hospital. Because I couldn't go to the hospital because I had 8 warrants out for my arrest, most of which were violent. And this particular night, I had a little Jack Daniels left, just a little bit, just that last swallow. And I wanted it desperately, but I didn't want to have my last bit without a cigarette. And I had no cigarettes. And I hit all the local shops where they had this, where people put their cigarette butts out and they were all emptied. And I was getting desperate. And I looked down, there was somebody else's half-smoked cigarette butt, and I just found a piece of gold. I cleaned it up, dried it off, lit it, took out the Jack Daniels, took that last swig and talked to the Jack Daniels and said, "Thank you for you. At least I got you. They don't get me. They have no idea what it's like to be me. Look what they did to me. Look, that's a firefly. That's awesome to me. I'm from the city, so that's pretty cool." you guys are like, "Yeah, so firefly." Damn, firefly. Now I got to start over. "Hi, guys. I'm an alcoholic. My name is..." So I get picked up, 8:30. I get picked up on I ended up doing a purse snatching because I'm desperate and I need some purse to go. You know what's crazy to me is I did a lot of stuff out there and I hurt people doing it. And every single time I did it, that period that I was homeless, I always justified doing it because I needed a place to stay. I needed food and I needed a place to stay, and that's why I'm doing this. And I bought that every single time I did it. And I'd mug you and I'd rob your purse and I'd break into your car, into your home, and I'd hurt you. And I wouldn't turn any of that into shelter. That's where I went with it. More alcohol. Every single time. Not one time did I take a score and turn it into shelter. Every single time I took, because I had to have alcohol at that point. I absolutely had to have it. Absolutely had to have it. I get picked up by the Buffalo's Finest and they bring me down to jail and I get locked up for a period of time and I get out of there on an ankle bracelet parole. Now I was lucky to even have that. Now I'm on an ankle bracelet parole. Everybody's familiar with what that is. Get the ankle bracelet. State of New York, in my case, kept tabs on me everywhere I was. I had a parole officer that stopped by two or three times a day. And one of the stipulations was you can't drink. Jake, you can't drink. If you drink, you're violated. And so for the first time in my life, I thought, good deal. I won't drink. I won't drink for the duration of this parole. Now, I didn't think there'd be any problem with that because I'm facing all kinds of stuff. I got multiple warrants that would come slamming back at me if I drink again, plus violating parole. I am done. I'm done. Plus all the times I already stood in front of that judge, he does not want to see me again. There's no way I'm going to drink. You're telling me all I have to do is not drink and I can stay out of that? We're good. There's no problem here, right? I'm not stupid. We're not dumb people. It never occurred to me, even for a second, that maybe I couldn't not drink. Because I never tried before, right? My drinking is characterized by trying to drink successfully the way I want to drink. This is the first time in my life I ever tried to not drink. And I went for a long time without drinking alcohol for an alcoholic of my type. It was like 10 days. 10 days before I heard a rap on my door and a couple of my buddies came over and they said, hey, I heard you got out. You should let us know. Have you celebrated yet? And I said, what do you mean have I celebrated? I mean, I'm out, man. That's good enough for me. I don't want to go back there. And they said, no. Have you celebrated? And he opened up his jacket and he had a bottle of Goldschläger there. I don't even like Goldschläger, but it's alcohol. And I thought, this man's a genius. Why aren't they giving people like him the Nobel Peace Prize with ideas like this? I haven't celebrated. You know what? I haven't celebrated, and I've been through a lot. I mean, you laugh, but I really have. I was homeless for months on end. No loneliness. I mean, if you're homeless, you understand loneliness. And I'm sick. I was sick that whole time. I was almost all the frostbite. And then I had to go to jail. And a couple of people that I started fights with outside of jail were in jail. So that got real fun, right? I mean, I'm just tired. I just went through so much. I know I'm not supposed to drink. I get it. But this one time's not going to, right? I mean, I can drink this one time. This is one time. I deserve it, right? I deserve it. And so I drank. I got the bottle of Goldschläger out of his hand, and I'm up like this drinking it before I realize this probably isn't the best idea. But by then, right, it's too late. Sets off that allergy. And I couldn't get the idea of drinking out of my head, literally for the life of me. Literally after that. I had a hard time drawing a sober breath. And I ended up, I tried a lot of stuff. Because of that parole, I was in different programs and I had people around me who tried to help me with my drinking. These are good people. Good people. Anybody who's in the industry who tries to help us, they're good people. They may not have the solution, but they're good people. And they would tell me things that made a lot of sense. A tremendous amount of sense. And I guess I didn't realize then, I can tell you I didn't realize then, that where alcohol is concerned, I'm insane. I lack the ability to reason whatsoever where alcohol is concerned. So any solution that makes sense to me is not going to work. I can't apply sanity in and of myself to my insanity. So I'll give you an example. They would say things like change people, places, and things. Stop hanging out in the projects. Stop. If you stop hanging out in the projects, there's a good chance you won't get drunk. And if you do find yourself in a position where you want to get drunk, just play the tape all the way through and remember being homeless. Right? I think that does make a tremendous amount of sense. I should stop hanging out in the projects, and I should... And every time I think about drinking, I think about like a martini. And I've never even had a martini, but that's what I think about is a martini, right? The good stuff. I got to remember being homeless. I can just remember being homeless. And so I would do that, and I would do that with some success. See, it says in our book, it says that at certain times, I'm not going to be able to bring about with sufficient force that sort of memory to deter me from taking a drink, but sometimes I can. So I'd be thinking, I'd be, oh my God, I want a drink. I'm really close to a drink. And I'd look around and be like, oh, bad people. Let me get out of here. And I would. Whew. And then I'd be in a position where like, oh, I want a drink. I want a drink. Oh, it's not a martini. It's homelessness. And I'd, whew. And I'd get through it. And then I'd go, oh, I really want a drink. I really want a drink. I'm drinking. That's all there is to it. I got nothing to throw at that deal. So it got to the point where I'm ready to violate. My parole officer came over with his full cop suit on, and he had the handcuffs out and everything. And something from deep down within rose up, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I don't even want to drink. It doesn't do anything like it used to for me. I'm done. And my mother, who's a skeptic of skeptics, I mean, she knew I was lying when I was talking. Lying was my native language, she'd always say. Saw that there was something different about it this time. And she said, I think he means business. And I did. I absolutely did. With everything I had in me. I woke up the next day. It was August 16th, 1997. And I lasted until about noon. And I was hammered. I mean hammered. Blitzed. I don't even know how. To this day, I have no idea how I got home. 17th was the same thing. And the 18th was the same way. Just stayed drunk. August 19th, 1997, I wanted to die more than I wanted to do anything. Because at that point, I absolutely knew without a shadow of a doubt that for me there was no hope, that I would end up in a long term, I'd be in prison for a very long time, or I'd be dead soon, which was way more welcoming. But I knew that for me there was no turning my life around. I was toast, hopeless. And at that moment, God sent one of you to me. He said, recovered alcoholic. And this man sat down with me, and he never once talked to me about my drinking, not once. And he never told me not to drink, not once, which was a new approach. I had everybody my whole life tell me, don't drink. This man never not once said that. All he talked about was what happens when he drank. And he started putting things in the words. I thought I was convinced I was the only one that knew what it was like to feel those things. He just freely opened that. He 12-stepped me. I'm a result of a 12-step call. At the end of that conversation, which is only about an hour, he said, what are you willing to do to get better? And I said, anything. And he said, good, I'll be at your house tomorrow. We'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, what else you got? Right? Wasn't that interesting? We talked to me, and I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met a bunch of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with AA. I didn't like everybody in AA, but I absolutely fell in love with the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think what I loved most about AA is I felt safe. Probably for the first time in my whole life, I felt safe. That safety is sacred in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's important that we all feel safe in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group, you can come to my home group and feel safe, and it doesn't matter if you're a male or a female, if you're attractive or unattractive, nobody's going to mess with you there. We make damn sure of it because that safety is sacred. I hope every group is like that. And I went as long as I could, as much as I possibly could. And it seemed like I lasted about 3 months going to lots of meetings, making lots of coffee, all good stuff. But Alcoholics Anonymous, the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't realize are not designed to change me. And it becomes deceiving because there is power here. I mean, I felt it when I pulled up and there was only a couple people here. I saw a one-on-one going in the back. You could tell it was like a thing that was happening. You could just feel the energy. There's another guy we connected and then another guy we connected right away. And there's that power that's going here and it feels good. And so while I'm here, I feel that and I feel like I'm plugged in and it's awesome. It's awesome. And then I go home and I'm alone or I'm with a family or I'm with a difficult boss. I've got all these life demands. I have no idea how to live. None. My life's unmanageable. Page 52 is all over the place for me, the bedevilment of alcoholics. And so what I do is I run back to another meeting. I'm squirming and I'm uncomfortable. I'm climbing out of my skin all day. And I run to another meeting. And I plan on telling you how terrible it was out there. Horrible. But I get here and I feel better instantly. Because I get in that presence. And you go, how you doing? And I go, glad to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the response usually is, you're in the right place. We're glad you're here. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But at some point, the questions need to be asked. See, I was at a meeting one time, and I was talking all this stuff, and this gentleman came up to me. He was in town from out of town, and he said to me, hey, do you mind staying after for a minute? I want to ask you something. And I said, sure. And we stood down, and he said, do you have a big book on you? And I said, no. And he said, oh, well, why would you bring a big book to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I get it. Well, I have one. And he slid around this big book, and it landed right in front of me. And he said, I'm having a really tough time because what you were saying, I just can't seem to find that in this book. And I figured since you were saying it, you would know where it was. So could you just show me where that is? I'm like, I'm ready to, right? I mean, what love? What love? I mean, how many people are willing to do that? See, what I would rather do is hear somebody not speak the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or speak our language and then talk crap about them for an hour and a half at a coffee shop, nice and safe and protected with like-minded people. But that's not what our book, that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous tells me to do. It says get into the sordid, challenge one another in a loving way. Because he said to me, and he went, stop right there. He said, let me tell you what it looks like when I drink. When I drink, I end up homeless. I drink no matter what. I can't stop drinking. I'm of the hopeless variety. Does that look anything like you? And I said, it looked exactly like me. And he leaned in and he looked me dead in the eye and he said, if you don't find out what's in this book and start applying it to your life and get connected with that power, and then start carrying that message that the alcoholic still suffers, not only are you going to die, but you're going to kill a lot of people on your way out. And then he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, okay, buddy. And he patted it with a big smile. And I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know what just hit me. All kinds of love and truth just hit me. And it paralyzed me and unarmed me. And I secretly was dying. And I chased that man down a couple weeks later. And we sat down and we got into the work, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I found out is that the program, the 12 steps, are designed to get me in contact with a power who creates my life. That's what changes my life. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous helps me hold accountable to that power. That's the fellowship I come from. That's the fellowship I create. Come to Buffalo, New York. That's where you're going to see a bunch of guys love on one another. And that isn't just always patting each other on the head. That's sometimes giving the phone call going, what's going on with you? How come you're not, you haven't sponsored somebody in 2 months. Do you need to reconnect here? You're not doing this thing. What's going on with you? We embarked on this thing, and I realized that I'm powerless over alcohol. That means I'm going to drink no matter what, / that my life's unmanageable. That's sober. I don't know how to live my life. That I need to connect with a God. I need to come to believe that power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. The sanity is I pick up a drink no matter what. And I hated God. I absolutely hated God. And he said, that's no problem. That's fine. I said, well, what do you mean? It just says right here, I got to believe in God. He said, no, you don't. You have to open your mind. Stop thinking you know everything about everything and listen once in a while. Just open your mind. Can you be willing to open your mind? Maybe, Jake, maybe. And he rolled up my pant leg and looked at my ankle bracelet and said, maybe you're wrong. Maybe you don't know. I went, right? So these steps aren't designed to, my experience is that the longer I take doing these steps, the longer my mind is able to connect and have an intellectual journey. And I don't think that an intellectual journey is one that we're talking about here. I think we need a spiritual journey through this thing, which is ego deflation, ego deflation, that, you know, a little more die to self, a little less self-reliant, so that I feel helpless. Here I am. What do I do? What's next? Make a decision to turn our will and life over the care of this God. Well, what does that look like? What does that mean? It means I got to quit playing God. I got to quit judging everything. Got to quit expecting that. You know, all the way out here, I'm fighting on what, you know, what's this meeting going to look like? What are they going to look like? How big is it going to be? What am I going to say? What am I not going to say? Just bringing it back to God. Shut up, right? I'm here to do as you design, right? And the nice thing is in that third step, I'm not turning my will of life over to God. I'm making a decision to. So what does that look like? I'm writing inventory. And I start writing inventory and I'm getting down to all the people, places, and institutions in which I'm resentful at, that I'm pissed at. I'm writing down all my fears and my sex conduct. Some pretty cool stuff comes out of that deal. I wrote down my dad. I hated my dad. I literally I had homicidal thoughts about my dad. I just didn't think about him because I saw him one time and I literally turned around. I had to go by where he was sitting on a porch. I hadn't seen him in years. And I couldn't go any further because I was going to kill him. I was going to wring his neck and take his life. I hated him. And he did a lot of the stuff that I hated him for happening when I was a really little kid. So I'm resentful of my dad. What did he do? This is what it affects. What are your own mistakes? I actually wrote F. I said F off, but I spelled it out, right? Screw you. Don't ask me that. And we talked about forgiveness. You got to be willing to forgive this guy. I said, fine, I'm willing to forgive him. 2 months later, I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and guests came through the door as a newcomer. My dad, at my home group. It wasn't just a meeting. It was my home group. So we get to embark on that journey. And I can tell you that we want to pray for patience, and we love speakers and speaker tapes and conventions and international. A couple weeks ago was awesome, but that stuff doesn't help us develop spiritually. It just gets us excited. But I'm not really growing spiritually. You know how I'm growing spiritually? By loving the unlovable. It's not glamorous. It's not glamorous at all. It's difficult. It's constantly trying to bring God's principles into situations I want nothing to do with, but God wants me in there. And that's what that deal was. And I got to develop a relationship with that man over the course of however many years it was. In Alcoholics Anonymous, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these principles. And he called me one day and he said, Jake, I'm dying of cancer. Would you be my healthcare proxy? And I said, yeah. And I went up to the hospital every day in hospice and dealt with hospice and got them all hooked up with all that. And every day I went up there and I just loved this old man. I just loved him. You know, I did whatever he'd say, you know, can you put lotion on my back? And I'd be like, really? Let me put lotion on you. I'll put lotion on you. And I put lotion on his back and I got him food and I fed him. And he hated him and my sister were estranged and I got them together. And at the end of his life, I got a phone call. Hospice called me and said, you better get up here. He's not looking good. And I got up there and I walked into the door and he's gasping. He's gasping. He's hanging on. He can't breathe. And it's an unpretty sight. And I went over to his side and I grabbed him and I tell him, Dad, you can go. You and I are square. There's nothing. There's nothing between us. I love you and I'm good. Go. And he leaned over. He kind of turned over and he squeezed my hand. And I felt, I witnessed and felt him let go. That's because you guys didn't let me give up. You guys never once said, you know what? Yeah, you're right. He is a jerk. You don't have to love jerks. I'd talk about what jerk he was, and they'd say, what does that have to do with you? You're a child of God. You're an instrument of God. You got to apply spiritual principles no matter what. And I go back in there and apply love, right? I mean, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's that second sheet of paper. I've only had this one way to react. He looked at me funny. What do we do? Punch him in the nose. Okay, right? And Alcoholics Anonymous, that didn't go anywhere. I still have that. You look at me funny, I review it. I know that's there. But Alcoholics Anonymous gave me this other sheet. You looked at me funny, punch him in the nose, or I can love him anyway. I could serve him. I can forgive him. 6 and 7. I wish I had more time. I'll give a 2-hour talk tonight. Everybody's, no. 6 and 7, my deal with 6 and 7, for a long time I used to think that I'm supposed to just ask God to remove the things, and he'll remove the things as he sees fit, and none of it has anything to do with me. And I've come to find that that's really just a convenient cop-out. I have a lot of work to do in 6 and 7, because that's what 6 says, right? I mean, there's not a lot of writing on them in our book, but read what's there. It's pretty powerful, pretty profound. Can he now remove all of my defects of character, every single one of them? Right? Not just the ones that he thinks is useful, or I think is useful, or he's going to use me or not use me. Every one of them. And if I haven't the will to do this, I need to pray for it to come. I need to be ready. And my experience is, in those scenarios, when I'm not ready for him to have those defects of character removed, get ready for some jackpots. They're coming my way. That'll bite me. 8 and 9, I made amends to people. I remember walking. I had an amends to make, and this person's family in person, I just destroyed. I put their son in the hospital. And then when they confronted me about it, I put his wife in the hospital. And I ruined their family, their car. They had a minivan, and I just destroyed it. So I terrorized his family, physically and otherwise. And I had already paid for the minivan and those sorts of things because the courts made me do that. But I needed to go to this guy and see what else. What did that do to you? I needed to formally amend this guy. And I thought he was just going to kill me. And so instead of driving there, I walked, because anything I could do to delay getting there. And I got there, and I knocked on the door, and I said, "Hey, I don't know if you remember me. A few years back, you know, this is generally what happened. And, you know, I was really sickened by alcoholism. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous now. In order for me to get well, I got to write that. And I truly want to write that, is there, you know, the amends process." And he's kind of looking at me like I got a foreign object coming out of my forehead. And I'm thinking, maybe he forgot about it, right? I'm kind of getting excited, like maybe he just forgot about it and we can just move on. And then he stops and he goes, are you Jake Jarosz? And I went, "Yeah, man, that's why I'm trying to amend this whole thing." And he's looking at me, he's like, "You don't look like Jake Jarosz." And I said, "Well, I can assure you that I am." And he said, "What the hell happened to you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been introduced to this God." And he said, "My son can't quit drinking, and we don't know what to do with it. It's driving us nuts. Me and my wife are on the brink of a divorce over fighting over how to handle this kid. You think you could talk to him?" And I said, "It just so happens that my very life as an ex-problem alcoholic depends on my ability to talk to people like your son. Where is he at?" And we set that up, and I set that kid on a path. He didn't stay with Alcoholics Anonymous right now, but he knows where to go. And I was able to talk to them about Al-Anon. She actually joined Al-Anon. And from time to time we have contacts. You never know what's going to happen when we go out there to set this stuff right. 10, 11, and 12. What happened to me is I got through the steps and I became an AA hotshot, and I started sponsoring a bunch of guys, and I started telling the rest of my area that they weren't doing AA right. You know, it's tough because we get excited, we get enthusiastic, and it even happens to me to this day. I'll get enthusiastic and I'll become God's deputy, which isn't bad. But the problem with being God's deputy is that the position's not open, right? And even if it was, I'm not a qualified applicant, right? That's not what he's calling me to do. But it's a great distraction tool, man, because I can skip all kinds of quiet time and looking at myself, worried about the sad state of the AA nation, right? I can start worrying all kinds of stuff about, you know, the guys I sponsor and the message they're carrying, instead of really looking at what's going on with me. And the next thing you know, my stories become stale. I stand at podiums like this or at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tell you about all the stuff God did for me 5 years ago plus. I can't give you one story about how God was relevant in my life today, this week, right? Last week, recently, what's going on right now? Where's God challenging me right now? Because my experience is, if I don't feel like I'm just a little bit over my head, I'm not pushing out enough. I'm getting too comfortable, because I got a long, long ways to go, And so 10, I got to stay current. I got to have God stories. I got to have current God stories. Right now, it's, I mean, my daughter, man, that is such a cool thing. It's all about my daughter. We were pregnant 3 years ago. I called my spiritual advisor and I said, we're pregnant. And he goes, that's wonderful. Now tell me about the fears. And I thought you'd never ask, right? And so I went on and on about how, you know, finances and this, and I've never done that. And I got a terrible, like, you know, demonstration of like what a family, normal family should look like or functional. And I don't know what I'm doing, yada, yada, yada. And he went, okay. I'm like, what do you mean, okay? He said, well, you can do that. You can listen to all of that and be miserable and have this just be the worst experience of your entire life and screw it up terribly and screw that little girl's life up. You can do that. I said, oh, okay, I don't want to, though. And he said, that's then good. He goes, because then you can use this experience to help draw you closer to God, your wife, and this little girl. Right? So much of it is just perspective. And we looked at all those fears were self-centered. Every last one of them. It wasn't really about her, my wife. Never even considered her, right? That little girl's well-being. It was just all about what kind of dad am I going to be and how am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? So I've opened up, man. I've learned so much about God from this little girl. It's unbelievable. And this little girl's awesome. You know what's going on? I haven't screwed up. It hasn't quite been 2 years. It'll be 2 years at the end of August. But so far, so good. This little girl doesn't know what violence is. She has no idea. She doesn't know what it's like to watch her mom and dad fight and argue. It makes me emotional because it's the only kid in my whole bloodline. And that's because of everything that I am. That little girl's life is because of you guys. It's because of God, as he demonstrated through you guys. As cool as that is, I did not get sober to be a dad. I own and operate a business. I didn't get sober to own and operate a business. I didn't get sober to have a good life. That's not the payoff. That stuff's bonus. The payoff is that I get the power to recreate lives. I get to be a sponsor. I get to know what this is like. I get to know what suffering is like. Go into that suffering and set a man on the right path to God. Hook him up and get that connection. That's the deal. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to be a sponsor. The longer I'm sober, the more important, the more necessary it is for me to be a sponsor. My heart used to be hard and self-centered, and it still very much can be, but the 12 steps are designed to move it from that to soften a servant's heart, the heart of a servant, other-centered, right? All of these things, it's like I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no power. Lack of power is my dilemma. I learned that. So where am I going to get the power? So I take some steps and I get a power strip. I take a few more steps and I plug the power strip in. And I take a few more steps all the way up to about 11. And then I get all the stuff in my life plugged into that power strip. And that power strip plugged into the main source. Yet I can't quite get access to power. There's still something missing. And I'm so tempted then to just try to take the first 11 again and again and again. But I've missed something very important that on every power strip that I've ever known of, is, and including the spiritual power strip I refer to, there's a little toggle switch, right? And the toggle switch on the power strip I'm referring to, the spiritual one, is marked other-centered and self-centered. When that thing's on others, I get all the power I need. See, I just intuitively know how to be a little girl's dad. I intuitively know how to listen to a guy's inventory. Because I'm interested, I'm listening, and it comes. I intuitively know how to run a business. I have enough humility to ask when I don't. It's all about that. When I stop that deal, I implode. My alcoholism, the worst characteristics about my alcoholism, the most predominant characteristic is my inability to even consider another human being. It's not that I hate you, I just didn't even think about you. You weren't even a part of the equation. God came in and softened my heart. And of course, that process of the 12 steps, I was walking down the street and I seen somebody get out of their car and they left the car running. Keys in it, car running, wide open. And my first thought, of course, is you get in the car and you go, right? It's his fault for being so stupid, right? I mean, it's just common knowledge. And then up to that point, because I was in an AA, I'd fight that. And I'd be like, oh, I can't do that because I can't, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. But that's not what happened. As a result of taking these steps, somewhere in that process, something changed. And I thought, get in the car and go. And the next thought was, no, because how would that man feel when he came back outside? And his car was missing. That rocks me to my core. That's so foreign to me, it's unbelievable. That's a God working in my life. It's unbelievable. There was an alcoholic. He was walking along and he fell in a ditch. It was a deep ditch, treacherous ditch, and he couldn't get out of it. He tried for weeks and weeks and weeks, everything he could to get out of this ditch, and he just couldn't get out. So he did something really drastic, and he yelled out for help. And somebody walking along, it was a minister walking along, and he said, he heard him. He goes, what's going on? He said, I fell in this ditch, and I can't get out. And the minister said, oh, okay, and he threw him a Bible, and he told him to read some scripture, and gave him a little sermon, and he prayed for him, and the alcoholic was very grateful. He felt so much better. At the end of spending an hour with this guy, he just felt great. The minister walked away, and the alcoholic, feeling better, still in that ditch. So he's no choice, starts yelling for help, help, help. And the psychiatrist comes along, and he says, what happened? He goes, I fell in this ditch, and I can't get out. So the psychiatrist pulls up a chair, sits back, and he starts asking him questions. He said, did your parents put you in this ditch? How do you feel about being in this ditch? And they talked for about an hour, and at the end of the hour, the psychiatrist said, I got to go now. And but remember what we talked about. And the alcoholic was very grateful because he felt a tremendous deal better. Tremendous deal. But as the psychiatrist left, he found that even though he felt better, he was still in the ditch. So he starts yelling, help, help, help. And the doctor comes along. He says, what happened? I fell in this ditch and I can't get out. And the doctor writes him a script and gives him some medicine. He says, take these. And so he starts taking them and he feels a lot better. And he's very grateful for the medicine and for the doctor and all of these people's help. But he's still in the ditch. So he starts yelling, help, help. And a recovered alcoholic comes along with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he goes, what happened? And he goes, I fell in this ditch and I can't get out. And without hesitation, the recovered alcoholic jumps in the hole with him. And the guy goes, what'd you do that for? Now we're both in this ditch. And the recovered alcoholic says, it's okay. I know the way out. Thanks for showing me the way out.